Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Allison Briscoe-Smith. Tonight, we're talking about FAFO parenting. That's FAFO, a viral trend that has taken social media by storm. It stands for F around and find out, as in let kids find out what happens when they make mistakes. We'll explore this parenting trend and some of the others with psychologist Dr. Nina Kaiser and learn under what conditions consequences might actually help kids learn. Then later in the hour, we'll hear about the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program. This innovative organization helps formerly incarcerated people build new lives as wildland firefighters, a path that not only empowers individuals, but also protects our state from the threat of climate-driven wildfires. But first, a major escalation of immigration enforcement was expected in the Bay Area, and it's been called off, at least for now. Earlier in the week, federal agents from ICE and Customs and Border Protection began arriving at Coast Guard Island between Alameda and Oakland, reportedly preparing for raids across the region. Their arrival sparked immediate protest, and several people were injured in clashes with law enforcement. By Friday, federal officials confirmed the operation had been canceled, not just in San Francisco, but throughout the Bay Area. Still, after days of tension and uncertainty, many residents and leaders remained unnerved. So what have we learned from this episode? Here to help us unpack what's happened and what might be coming next is Shomik Mukherjee, a reporter from the Bay Area News Group. Shomik's coverage includes Oakland with a focus on local politics, developments, and activism. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Shomik.
Hey, very kind of you to have me.
Well, thanks for being here with us. I know that I've been seeing this all throughout my feed. It's been very confusing as to what's going on. When are things happening? So maybe you can help us understand a bit. Can we start off with a little bit of background? Can you give us a summary of what has happened in the Bay Area at the end of last week?
Yeah, the end of last week was I guess, in short, a very chaotic period for the entire Bay Area. On Wednesday, the rumors began spreading that the Trump administration would order some kind of federal law enforcement to the Bay within the next several days. And by the next by Thursday morning, Customs and Border Protection agents were rolling in to Coast Guard Island, which is like in the estuary between Oakland and Alameda. And we're preparing to use that as sort of a staging ground before kind of conducting presumably raids within the East Bay and in San Francisco. San Francisco became kind of the big story on Thursday because President Trump came out and said that he had spoken to the mayor of San Francisco, Daniel Lurie, as well as to kind of associates he has in San Francisco's tech sphere, and made the decision that he would withdraw federal law enforcement from that city, San Francisco, the city across the bay from the East Bay. I cover Oakland for the East Bay Times. It sent us into a tizzy. It sent the rest of the East Bay into a tizzy because nobody really knew for sure whether Trump's post on the social media platform Truth Social would apply to the rest of the Bay Area. We were sort of thrown into this state of ambiguity, and that lasted for about 24 hours.
Yeah, it was a lot to manage, I imagine, from your viewpoint. But also, again, I know that our networks were mobilized. People were sending things throughout both kind of text and phone. And it was a lot of information, misinformation, how to even kind of make sense of it. But this is all kind of set in a backdrop of other kind of federal troops deployment. Can you take us even a step further back and give us a larger sense of the kind of context about how this kind of deployment is happening?
Yeah, absolutely. This was not unexpected for the Bay Area or for San Francisco. Trump has, since August, kind of announced that he was going to deploy the National Guard to major U.S. cities, especially ones that struggle with crime. This kind of followed him deploying the National Guard to L.A. in June, where protesters and had sort of clashed with ICE agents over immigration raids there. And I think, like, sort of after using the National Guard in that instance in June, he basically intimated that he was going to do the same for major U.S. cities, and he followed through on that. He took over the police department in Washington, D.C., and then he further ordered the National Guard to Chicago and to Portland. And this was something that had been like really forecasted by the White House and by the federal administration for the Bay Area for some time. He named Oakland as a city that he said was so far gone in crime. That's a quote. The mayor of Oakland, Barbara Lee, had sort of struck back, pointing out that Oakland's crime levels had declined. Notably, I should say for your listeners that this deployment on Thursday did not include the National Guard. And there was a kind of rumor that Trump would send the National Guard by the weekend, but by the time he had spoken to Mayor Lurie in San Francisco and to others around that area, he'd sort of decided to pull federal deployment overall. And like I said before, it was unclear exactly what he meant.
Yeah, as we're trying to move towards some kind of clarity in terms of what actually kind of happened when and also what's coming, can you take us back to, you kind of talked about the Coast Guard Island and that kind of estuary and that as kind of a potential kind of landing kind of space. What actually happened there? Are troops still there? Can you take us through that just a little bit more?
Absolutely. Yeah. My colleague, Sierra Lopez, who's done fantastic reporting for us, was at the island when a number of unmarked vehicles pulled up carrying Customs and Border Protection agents. And almost immediately, like very quickly in the morning, they began sort of clashing with protesters who'd assembled on the island. They were mostly peaceful protests. At one point, a CBP agent kind of unloaded a chemical agent at near point blank range into the face of a protester. And things were kind of raucous throughout most of the day. By nightfall, the CBP was no longer present, I guess, but there's a U-Haul truck that sort of backed up into the barrier that had been set up by Coast Guard security on the bridge that takes you between Oakland and Alameda. Coast Guard security opened fire on that truck. I was at the scene soon afterward and talked to protesters there who'd said that they were urging the driver of the U-Haul truck to not back up into this barrier and did not want to escalate the situation. An Alameda police officer who was standing guard at the scene said that he'd been sort of sent there to protect what was like now a cordoned off crime scene, and it was all very chaotic and kind of difficult to make sense of. But I should say that both the driver of the U-Haul truck who was struck by a bullet and an apparent bystander in the situation were treated for injuries and both lived. Mm.
You mentioned just the kind of involvement of the multiple kind of folks, whether it's, you know, police, National Guard. It's very confusing. Can we get kind of specific about what is the response of the Oakland law enforcement to what's kind of going on? You mentioned kind of Alameda, but if we can get some kind of understanding, what was the response of Oakland law enforcement to this plan?
Oakland police, between both police department leadership and the police officers union, which the latter of which tends to be a little bit more conservative about their approach to crime, they were pretty unified in saying that they respect Oakland sanctuary policies and didn't intend to sort of help or assist federal law enforcement in these kinds of in these deployments. I think law enforcement across the East Bay, including the Alameda County Sheriff's Office, have been clear that they're not really interested in what a person's immigration status is. They're not going to ask for papers. They are not going to assist a federal immigration authority in arresting somebody. At the same time, these federal authorities have sort of acted with relative impunity. There's really nothing that the local jurisdictions can do to stop them from showing up in town, which is what sort of the protesters that I spoke to took away from in this situation, is that in this sort of era of the second Trump administration, things are pretty unprecedented. There's not going to be a very forecasted deployment of federal troops in any situation. People are just going to show up, and I think at least the activists I spoke to are very determined to be ready when that happens.
Yeah, you've talked about the ways in which they're kind of showing up and readying to be present. You've also just talked a little bit about Oakland law enforcement in particular. Earlier, you talked about the ways in which local leaders were kind of pushing back, whether that was, Mayor Lee or Mayor Lurie. Can you tell us a little bit about what our leaders are doing in this time? What happened on that phone call? What if you know? But what do you think folks are kind of doing? What leadership is responding to what's going on?
Well, I think our companions across the Bay and in the San Francisco media world have reported that this is sort of the first time that Mayor Lurie has had to like explicitly confront the Trump administration. And at times he's sort of demurred from that. And in this case, he's kind of come forward announcing broad-based policies and general statements that align with immigrant communities. In the East Bay, cities and Alameda County have been very explicit in the fact that they are going to not just support sanctuary policies, but try to protect immigrants wherever they can. But I think the big takeaway of the last few months has been that the resources available for local authorities is fairly limited. They can't stop federal deployments. They can't stop troops from stationing in parts of the Bay. They can't stop federal law enforcement authorities from carrying out raids and arrests, from filling the city streets. What they can do is sort of support the people. And I think in the East Bay, you've seen fundraising efforts for legal firms like Centro Legal de la Raza. You've seen kind of a sort of solidarity between elected leaders and attorneys who are representing migrants detained by ICE, for instance. But yeah, it's been sort of a like it sometimes seems like the leaders here are kind of rummaging through the dark when it comes to federal presence. At one point, I spoke to the Alameda County Sheriff's officials in that office, and they were telling me that they weren't really sure exactly where federal agents went after Trump's announcement, after the East Bay had been, quote unquote, cleared, and they weren't exactly sure when those authorities had left the Bay, as it were.
All of this is so impactful for our community. We're definitely feeling it. I'm just wondering, in the last minute that we have, what have you heard, or what's the atmosphere like for our immigrant families? What are you hearing?
Yeah, well, I think people are on guard. People have been on guard for months. I don't think that what happened last week is changing anything for migrant communities. People were on guard in August, for instance, when ICE came and arrested six people in East Oakland. The entire community was on high alert. Over the weekend, the news came out that in Berkeley, a Dia de los Muertos celebration had been canceled because people were wary. In other parts of the Bay, in South San Francisco, there was a celebration of Latin heritage. People are kind of feeling out their level of comfort existing in public, existing in out in the world amid this looming threat from the administration. And even after this kind of skirmish, if you could call it that, where Trump deploys this federal law enforcement agency. No one knew it was coming. It lasts for about 24 hours, then he pulls them back, and then there's this period of uncertainty and ambiguity that ensues. Even amid all that, people are just not sure if that's for real, if maybe tomorrow authorities will be back at the door.
Well, we're gonna have to leave it here, but really want to thank you for providing some kind of clarity, helping us kind of to understand what's going on in the midst of lots of confusion, lots of fear, and a lot that's kind of going on for our communities. So thank you so much again for your reporting. Thank you, Shomik Mukherjee. He's a reporter at the Bay Area News Group. Thanks for joining us again on State of the Bay.
Thanks very much. Take care.
Thanks. Coming up next, after this short break, we're going to talk to Bay Area psychologist Nina Kaiser about FAFO parenting trend. Stay with us.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear how loyalty can destroy relationships.
When my brother was fighting this case, my loyalty shifted. It was said that Rock's brother had told on my brother, and I was always against snitching.
A new uncuffed story from the California Institution for Women. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Hi, I'm KALW executive producer Ben Trefney. KALW has been around for more than 80 years, and I've been here for more than 20. It's because I care about fact-based journalism, a global perspective, great music, and I love the Bay Area. The federal government is cutting our funding. So if what we do here at KALW matters to you, like it does to me, please help us right now. Make a donation at KALW.org, and if you can, make it monthly. Please join me in standing with KALW. Thanks.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Allison Briscoe-Smith. If you're a parent, or even if you're not one, you may have heard about a new trend making headlines. FAFO parenting. It's gone viral.
It is called FAFO. Have you heard this?
No.
Mess around and find out. The word is not mess.
Turn now to our parenting playbook. There's a new backlash against gentle parenting. A widely shared article in the Wall Street Journal says tough love is back. Our parenting expert, Erica Suter, is here to explain. What you have to explain first is this acronym associated with it, F-A-F-O.
Well, George, when parents have reached their limit, it's kind of like a mess around and find out kid. That's basically what's happening there.
Okay. FAFO parenting. Boy, am I excited to jump into this with you. I have so many thoughts, so many reactions. Let me say right from the start, I want to talk about what this acronym means. And that involves choice words that you might not want your kids to hear.
And we're going to start off with this fiery question, maybe for some parents.
So FAFO has been called a throwback to tough love parenting, letting kids face the hard consequences of their choices. And it may be a backlash against the gentle parenting movement, which emphasizes empathy and connection, often while risking parental exhaustion, burnout, isolation. But underneath all of these social media kind of memes and noise, there's some real questions here. How do we balance connection and boundaries while parenting? When should we step back and when do we step in? How do we kind of do this all? So tonight we're digging into the pros and cons of the way that I was parented, FAFO parenting, and what research says about how kids can actually learn from consequences with Dr. Nina Kaiser, a Bay Area psychologist and founder of Practice San Francisco. Nina is also a mother to two boys. Welcome, Nina.
Thank you, Allison. So glad to be here tonight and excited to dive into this conversation with you.
Excellent. We can't wait to hear from you. And we want to hear from our guests, other folks as well. Have you tried FAFO parenting in moments in your household? Were you raised that way? If they have worked or backfired, you can actually join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255 or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org or find us on social media, Blue Sky, Instagram, more. All right. Dr. Kaiser, let's start off with you. What is FAFO? I mean, we've heard a little bit about it, but let's start with the basics. What do you mean by it, or what are people talking about?
Yeah, people are talking about letting kids learn the hard way, basically. And I think FAFO parenting has this edge to it. Like I've told you a million times, so there, you know, just go ahead, right? Do what you're going to do, F around and find out. Like find out the hard way. I tried, I give up.
There seems to be, even as we heard in the kind of clips and as I've heard people kind of talk about, a sense of kind of like resonance. You know, I've kind of joked a little bit like that's the way that I was kind of parented. But, you know, can we think a little bit more about like how is this kind of being defined? Is it a quote unquote old school type of parenting or what's supposed to be part of this parenting?
Great question, Allison. I do think it's a throwback to old school parenting, and I think it has a kind of more modern, more edgy twist to it that comes from parents being completely burnt out, fried, under-supported, and really over getting too much parenting advice, right? I think there's backlash to the gentle parenting movement there and this real desire to figure out a way to make it easier and to revert back to the way that you're right, a lot of us were parented ourselves growing up.
Let's talk about what you've kind of raised, which is kind of gentle parenting. Can you give us a sense about what that's supposed to be, or maybe even how people make sense of it?
Yeah, gentle parenting really relies on empathy and connection with your kids, really making a point of kind of hearing, understanding, validating their emotions, and really meeting kids' emotional needs over the course of time, all of which is really well intentioned, right? And so important. And I think the gentle parenting movement as a whole has maybe gone a little bit too far on the continuum of, you know, if we kind of go from really authoritarian parenting to more permissive parenting, a lot of gentle parenting winds up at the really permissive end of that continuum. Because it's hard, I think, for parents to figure out how do we validate emotions and our kids' emotional experiences and still hold limits and set limits around behavior.
I think you've said something that a lot of people are like breathing a sigh of, which is the thought and the idea that gentle parenting has maybe gone too far. To hear that from a psychologist is probably pretty validating. This idea that kind of parenting swings. You also talked about something that I think we want to kind of come back to, which is authoritarian parenting and permissive. These are kind of four quadrants of parenting that we tend to kind of think about that manage things like warmth and demandingness. Can you tell us just a little bit about, you know, that kind of sweet spot that you might think of in this type of parenting?
Yeah, you want to ideally be balancing limit setting and kind of hard stops around behavior that's not acceptable while still working with kids collaboratively to teach them the skills that they need to flourish and, you know, to feel that sense of connection, belonging, and caring with you as an adult. Attachment figure in their lives, right? So, for example, you mentioned I've got two kids. I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. My 6-year-old is a pretty fiery guy, and we're often being like, you know, man, like you're allowed to be mad and you're not allowed to hit your brother, right? Two things are true, right? Yeah. I love you. You're having a big feeling. I'm here with you while you're calming yourself down, and hitting your brother is off limits, right? So it's kind of being there, you know, in an ideal world, we're existing in that space of like holding their emotional experience, working with them to learn some skills, but also really setting limits around behavior that's not appropriate, not acceptable in that moment.
This limit setting kind of piece seems to be something that maybe has gotten kind of lost in the wash. And I'm curious as to whether or not the kind of move around to kind of like F around and find out is kind of a backswing to kind of consequences and boundaries. But there's this kind of language that folks are using about natural consequences. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, natural consequences are consequences that come directly from a child's behavior. So, like, for example, if your child, like my fourth grader, refuses to wear a sweatshirt to school, then natural consequence of that is he's going to be kind of cold, right? So it's a consequence that's directly associated with and directly stems from the behavior that your child is doing. If they pull the cat's tail, the natural consequence would be that the cat is going to scratch them, right?
So those are kind of consequences that come about from the kid or their kid's kind of experiences, which stands in contrast to what we often do in kind of gentle or other types of parenting, which is that we're enforcing the consequences. Is that the kind of idea?
Yeah, I think so. And I think some, you know, again, there's sort of this continuum, right, of gentle parenting. But in the most extreme versions, gentle parenting, I think, has lost that conversation about consequences or about limits. But you're absolutely right. A lot of other consequences that parents use are not natural consequences. They don't stem directly from the child's behavior or choice. You know, there are some consequences that are logical consequences. So, for example, you throw your fire truck and you can't play with the fire truck anymore, right? The natural consequence is if it's broken and you can't play with it. But the logical consequence is it didn't break, but you're still not allowed to use it anymore because you didn't play with it appropriately, right? And there are other consequences that we use that just aren't related to the behavior. Like, you know, you destroyed your bedroom, so therefore you lose your movies or your screen time for the week, right? So there are a lot of different ways that we can use consequences or you know, across parenting, some of which are more effective than others.
Right. I think it's so helpful to kind of dig into these distinctions. I know that I'm often working with parents where we're getting kind of confused about what the consequence is and what to kind of do. But there's also this kind of piece around our over-involvement as parents. You know, it's been talked about as helicopter or snowplow, or actually we're either preventing the consequences from happening or we're kind of doing it all for them. I was curious if you have quick thoughts about kind of the over-involvement that this is kind of in response to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a phenomenon, Allison. Our team does a lot of work, not only directly with children and families, but also with schools. And we've heard from school after school that families are really struggling with kind of overly permissiveness, over helicoptering post-pandemic, just because of all of the stress that kids and teenagers went through. That, you know, as parents, our inclination, and as good parents, right, our inclination is to protect our kids, to support them, to buffer them from pain, from challenges. And unfortunately, those are also growth opportunities and learning opportunities and skill development opportunities for our kids. And so in order to be most effective as parents, ultimately, we do need to let our kids suffer the consequences sometimes of their own decisions, right? To get out there and to learn those lessons really powerfully for themselves. I mean, obviously there are limits to that, right? That, you know, when we talk about FAFO parenting or we talk about natural consequences, you know, we're not talking about things that are physically dangerous to your child, right? We don't want to risk their safety or their well-being, but we do want to give them the opportunity to make mistakes and to learn from those mistakes at a lower level, right? So, you know, I think I gave you the example a few minutes ago of like my fourth grader loves to go to school without a sweatshirt. And that's a different level of consequence than like, you know, if he was up in Tahoe in the middle of winter going outside with no jacket or no coat, right? We'd have a different conversation there. But it's tough.
Yeah, those distinctions are really, really helpful. We're going to come on back to it just real quick. I just want to say again that this is State of the Bay on local public radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm your guest host, Allison Briscoe-Smith. And tonight we're talking about the viral parenting trend known as FAFO. That's F around and find out. And we'd actually love to hear from you. How do you set boundaries or use natural consequences in your own home? Have those consequences taught your child any lasting lessons or just create stress for everyone? You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on all the social media places. I want to come back to this piece, Nina, that you were kind of talking about, like, this is difficult. This is kind of challenging for us to kind of do. You have kind of raised up at the top with some of the consequences of gentle parenting and perhaps this other over-involvement is parental exhaustion. Can you tell us just a little bit about what's kind of burning us out as kind of parents and, again, how this might be a response?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what isn't burning us out as parents? The former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy last year released the health advisory about parental health and well-being, right? I think there's general awareness and acknowledgement that as a country in this moment, we don't have a lot of societal supports for parents, right? Families are living, you know, more and more families are living physically distant from their families of origin. So we have less help, less support. Childcare is more expensive. Rising costs impact families, you know, to a larger degree, more mouths to feed, more space to inhabit, costs of childcare, and so on. In addition to that, I feel like there has been this cultural narrative around parenthood that has really shifted since the time that, you know, for example, I was a kid or you were a kid. Allison, my mom didn't think about like sending us out to the backyard or making us entertain ourselves. Right. And so there's this higher bar for us as parents that's so visible 24/7 through social media, through the onslaught of parenting books, parenting influencers. And I think parents are just tired. A lot of input without a lot of support.
That's a great way of putting it. In fact, what you just said really spoke to one of our listeners. A listener just wrote in and said, thank you. Gentle parenting is exhausting. Constant empathy, calm, and validation can feel like too much when kids keep pushing limits. I'm sure you hear stuff like this all the time in your practice, this kind of resonance with like, this is just too much. But it also really does seem like we've somehow gotten it wrong. That's not really what I would like to support folks in doing, is to always constantly to be ever giving. But it's somehow the notion about what parents think we're supposed to be doing. I'm curious, you're seeing this kind of come up in the parents that you serve, this kind of, you know, the burnout feeling, the stress, what this kind of person just says as well. You're seeing that as well, Nina?
Completely. Yes. Oh, Allison, and to the listener out there, I mean, this is, you're feeling the same way as so many other parents out there. I think, you know, we get locked into this idea of this is the right way to parent, is the emotional validation, you know, and again, there is power there, right? Like, I want to be very clear, like, I'm not discarding this idea that we should be validating our kids' emotional experiences. And I want to let us all off the hook. Like, we do not have to be perfect. And there is a gift for our children when we are not, because we give them the opportunity, one, to like have that experience of seeing us be imperfect beings, and then to also, for us, be able to model like apologizing and repair and fixing things, right? And that's a gift to our kids to teach them those skills and to show them those skills in action.
That's a beautiful way of really framing it. And, you know, the idea that we can apologize and make mistakes, but a lot of this is really, this kind of FAFO idea is about the idea of letting our kids live with mistakes. Now, you've talked already around, there are some boundaries, there are some pieces around, you know, physical kind of stuff, but in general, we're talking about having kids be able to learn. We have a question that comes up, which I think is kind of emblematic of how tough this really is, which is the question from a listener is there a healthy middle ground between gentle parenting and FAFO? How do we give kids the freedom to learn from mistakes without feeling like we're giving up on guidance and structure?
Absolutely. That is such a wonderful question. And I think the answer lies in collaborative conversation with our kids before the decision is made, right? So, you know, just to kind of not to beat a dead horse with this example with my fourth grader, but it really does drive me crazy when he doesn't wear a sweatshirt at these dates that are so cold, right? But we're talking about it ahead of time. I'm being like, hey, man, let's look at the weather forecast together. This is ultimately your decision, right? But I'm going to arm you with the information that you need to hopefully make an informed decision. And maybe it's still not the right decision, but we're going to have talked through it together. You know, and after the fact, if you made a decision that you have some regrets about, I'm going to problem solve, I'm going to process, I'm going to replay that decision with you so that you can make a different decision next time. And I think part of the thing that rubs me a little bit wrong about the FAFO label is I do feel like it has this like edge of like, ha ha, you made the wrong decision. You effed around and you found out, right? But ideally, I think if we're supporting learning, we're bringing in some of those elements of gentle parenting to help our kids make the decision in the first place, affirm that relationship or connection, and then let them, you know, we're trusting them to make the right decision. And we're there to support them if and when that decision doesn't pan out.
Right. That, I think that's a really important piece, is that we're here to support them when it doesn't necessarily work out. There's been a trend within parenting is that we're here to support them has translated into, so we don't let them make the mistake.
Right.
And, you know, you've kind of highlighted the importance of them seeing us make mistakes, but we also need to let them learn and grow. It's hard to know what that balance really is, but, you know, we can swing back a little bit to let them kind of try it out on their own. Now, we also know that trying out on our own is consequential for us. Like, as you talked about, Nina, like, if he comes home with a cold, then I gotta support him kind of through that. Or I'm thinking about a recent example, which is that my older son, I told him not to take a particular type of class that he was gearing up to within high school. And it wasn't because I didn't believe he could do it. It was just that his workload was so hard. I wanted to have him have an opportunity to have a little bit of a break. He went ahead and decided to do the class anyway, which is great, bold, awesome. But now we're spending a ton of time trying to resource him to meet that really challenging kind of class, right? And it's not just a consequence for him. Now it's a consequence for me and my mom who does the math and all these other kinds of pieces. So it's helpful for us to kind of think about, yes, there was a learning, but there's a learning for us as well. And the consequences, especially with young kids, with all of our kids, it's not just a consequence for the kid. It's often for us as well. So I'm curious, Nina, how do you help us manage when things go wrong for our kids and the consequences that show up for us?
Yeah, that is such a tough one. And oh my gosh, my empathy is with you and with your mom and with your son here, Allison.
It's good my mom does the math.
That is a great thing to be able to delegate. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think in an ideal world, you know, there still are places as parents that our job is to set a firm limit with our kids, right? And so much as, you know, in the way that we wouldn't let a kid F around and find out about safety-related behaviors, if we have, you know, a lot of confidence that, hey, this decision is probably going to, you know, be a huge burden for you, for us, for the entire family, that's the situation where I think you can sit down with your kid and say ahead of time, like, hey, actually, you know, I feel really strongly about this. And I have a lot of faith in you, a lot of confidence in you. And I don't think that I'm capable of providing the support mm-hmm. that you're going to need to make this happen. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and drawing a line before it happens. And that said, you know, there obviously are going to be times that we get there and we're like, oh, mm-hmm. these consequences are more than we expected, or the way this burden is like more to carry than we expected. In those moments, I'd probably start by doing some problem solving with yeah. your child, right? Collaborative problem solving, being like, okay, this is, you know, kind of what we talked about before. This is the way things seem to be going. What are your thoughts about yeah. how we could problem solve here to try to make this situation a little bit easier, a little bit less burdensome? Mm-hmm. But it's hard. I mean, then mm-hmm. some of it, unfortunately, is just muscling through it, right? Talking yeah. about the learning point and the lesson for next yep. time. Yeah. But yeah,
it's a great way of thinking about kind of muscling through, because it's the muscle that we need to develop with practice. And even the framing that you just provided of how complex it is, I need to recalibrate, gives us a little bit of space to feel like, you know, we're works in progress. Both, like, I've never parented a 17-year-old before, you know, so, or this particular child before. So this kind of muscle, like, to build up. You also are giving us and pointing out something that can be really helpful, which is a lot of the kind of parenting and the discipline and the consequences actually comes before the action. It comes in the conversation that we've had before, in the slow moments before, we're kind of gearing up, not just in the moment. But, you know, there's another piece that just to kind of lean into, which is the, you know, the big variety of our children, who we are gifted to learn with, that there are differences in how our kids kind of respond. You mentioned, you know, a spicy older kid and, you know, differences kind of here. But we do have kind of a question, or actually kind of a comment, that poses another place for us to kind of think about in terms of all of our kids. So we have a listener that wrote in that says, as a person with a developmental disability, I would say that when it comes to children and adults with developmental disabilities, that we need to be very careful when using the style of parenting. While I agree that the natural consequences of actions are important, remember that many people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, we learn through association, but a lot of us, including myself, that we are learners, we learn differently, slow learners. Just curious yeah. as to how that lands, or what you think.
I think that is spot on, Allison. I know in some of the messages that we traded before going on air, we talked about the fact that this approach is not an approach that's going to be well-suited for every kid. We don't want to set our kids up to fail, right? So where we know that a child is really struggling, whether that's a disability, whether it's a skill deficit in some sort of way, no matter what is driving that, we want to be thinking about how we can scaffold and support kids in building skills rather than just setting them up to fail, right? So if you, for example, have a kid who has ADHD and is super impulsive, right, then this is going to be a harder approach for them and probably not ideal, right? Because you have a kid who's having more trouble probably thinking through their decisions before they get there, maybe having more trouble with organization, with executive functioning, with planning ahead, right? So I think this listener's point is so well taken, that we have to be careful, right? That we're not just setting our kids up to fail or putting them under expectations that aren't going to be possible for mm-hmm. them to meet.
Mm-hmm. You know, it also gives us kind of an opportunity to just think about the expertise that we have with our own kids. You know, whether it's we're talking about, like, I have one anxious one. I have one bold one. I have one fiery one. I have one that ADHD is present. We have to really just be thoughtful that we have to know our kids. And sometimes, you know, the one size fits all that comes up on a reel or on a podcast might not actually work for what's going on with our kids. And that, again, I think is a place that's really difficult. I know I have a lot of folks in my practice that are frustrated that we have to kind of figure out another kind of way. And, you know, I hear you also talking about the ways that we have to pay attention and really know what's going on for our kids. Within that kind of knowing and understanding our kids, again, I want us to kind of come back to this swing between FAFO and also gentle parenting and come back to your sound advice about how to think about consequences for our kids in the midst of all that. So if you had to kind of give like a one shot about like ways of thinking about consequences with our kids, what would you kind of highlight and say?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately we want to be paying attention to how our kids respond and how their behavior changes when we use consequences, right? So ideally, if we're using consequences, whether that's, you know, logical consequences, natural consequences, some other kind of punishment or consequences, we want to see the behavior shifting and changing, right? We want to see the thing that we don't want to see stopping, right? Whether that's, you know, the kid forgetting their jacket or their homework or, you know, hitting their brother, whatever the situation is. But I also, I mean, I think, you know, Allison, to speak to your point from just a moment ago, every kid is different and every moment is different. And parenting is literally the only job where the demands shift, not only moment by moment, but year by year, right? And so I think it's just such an exercise in, honestly, trial and error, right? Doing our best, showing up with, you know, the best practices that we can in the moment, and then watching our kids to see if what we're doing is working, whether it's changing their behavior, whether it's impacting their relationship with us, and then, you know, course correcting from there.
You know, with all of that, it's no wonder that we're tired and no wonder that it's really hard. I hear you offering a bit of kind of grace for how demanding the kind of space is, how much we have to really make sense of it. And I'm just really curious as we kind of move towards wrapping up just a little bit about if this FAFO conversation has opened up anything in your practice as you talk to parents. Has it allowed us to kind of think maybe a little bit about some of the grace that we could offer ourselves? Or is there anything that this kind of conversation is inspiring that might be helpful for us as parents?
Absolutely. I mean, I think all of this, you know, shifting and changing in the parenting narrative underscores there really is no one right way to do this, right? Mm-hmm. And also as parents, again, the expectation is not for us to be perfect here, right? It's to know that we're human beings doing the best we can and paying attention so that we know if something isn't working, right? Or if something is impacting our relationship with our kids, then okay, time to do something different. Mm-hmm. Right? Not to beat ourselves up about what we've done so far, but to show up with some self-compassion and like, okay, let's put our problem-solving hat on and figure out how to do this differently.
And that's such a great invitation for us to also model to our children as well. They've got to learn how to do this. They have to learn how to grow up and take care of themselves and have compassion for themselves as well. And it's a great model that you're kind of providing for us. So just curious if you have like, if you had one kind of sentence to kind of leave us with, what would that be?
Yeah, don't be too hard on yourself. Parenting is hard. Kids don't come with a manual. You know, there are a lot of right ways to be a parent and a lot of right ways to show up for our kids.
What a beautiful way for us to kind of think about there are a lot of right ways. So as there's this whole kind of debate amongst FAFO versus this, you know, there's a whole lot that we can really do. There's a whole lot that we can kind of pick and choose and also have the ability to kind of grow and learn with our children as well. Dr. Kaiser, I really just want to thank you for your time and your advice and your advocacy on behalf of children and, you know, hoping that folks will reach out if they have any questions. But thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you so much, Dr. Briscoe-Smith.
Awesome. So my guest again tonight was Dr. Nina Kaiser, a Bay Area psychologist and founder of The Practice in San Francisco. So thank you for joining us on State of the Bay, Nina. And Coming up next after the break, we're going to hear from Royal Rami, one of the forestry and fire recruitment program. So go ahead and stay with us.
This week on Bay Made, we are getting in the Halloween spirit with scary, spooky tales from some of our favorite local podcasts, including East Bay Yesterday, Muni Diaries, Outside Lands, and Storied SF. So lock the doors and pull up an earbud all week at 11:30 a.m. for Bay Made, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco, Boo Area.
Next time you're browsing the web, click on over to KALW.org for the latest in local news and culture, updates from our music hosts, and unique features you can only hear from the talented crew at KALW Public Media. Visit KALW.org.
I'm Fred Pitts, and this is State of the Bay. Today, we are honored to have Royal Rami as our guest. Royal is the CEO and co-founder of the Forest and Fire Recruitment Program, which supports formerly incarcerated firefighters to pursue firefighting as a career after prison. Really impressive. Royal, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk to you and being able to talk about my story. And yeah, let's get to it.
This is really a pleasure. I've watched all of your interviews with John Stewart and the TED Talk, and I thought, man, this guy is everywhere. So thank you for being on our show. Let's just start at the beginning. After seeing all the interviews and reading about you, your story really is amazing. Just tell our listeners a little bit about what led you to found the Forest and Fire Recruitment Program.
Yes. So what led me to start in the organization is that I actually made a mistake when I was, you know, a young man, 20 years old, decided to rob a drug dealer thinking it would be easy money. And on July 1st, 2010, they shackled me up at 4 o'clock in the morning and took me to Tehachapi State Prison. Mm-hmm. Around that time, California was overcrowded and sent me out of state there for a couple of years. And then I had an opportunity to go to fire camp. And I was like, okay. I remember, you know, getting a knock on the door. There was like, you know, Rami 86610, get dressed, you go into annual review.
Okay.
And then go into the office and they said, based on your behavior, you're eligible for fire camp. Do you want to go? And they gave me 24 hours to decide because I was like, I don't even know what fire camp is.
Right.
So now when you're in prison, right, like fire camp is more about freedom. Right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you can live in a dormitory setting. You work in a community, and when you get visit from your family, you can actually get home-cooked meals. So when I figured that out, I was like, sign me up. Like, let's go. Right?
Okay.
But I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
Well, the word fire camp would have been a clue, I thought, but, you know.
Right? I'm thinking campfire, you know, like I was saying. Like, it's like a little, everybody in the woods and whatever doing a campfire. I had no idea, right?
Wow.
You know, I'm oblivious. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. I'm a city kid, you know, and I traded in my Air Jordans for those, you know, those super heavy, super dusty old boots and a 45-pound pack, a 5-pound hand tool. Yeah, it was crazy. And to be honest with you, like on my very first hike, my captain was like, you know, Rami, you're the youngest guy on the crew and you're the slowest. What's up? Like,
wow.
And I'm like, I'm exhausted, man. This is not an easy task. You know? Because when you're in prison, you're doing push-ups, pull-ups. You're not actually in the, you know, field and doing all that. So it was a whole different physical exertion, right, to be able to really do. So I end up slowly but surely just working and just continue to learn more about wildland firefighting. And, like, I just fell in love with it. And I wanted to pursue it as a career, but it was in no true pathway.
Okay.
Because when I heard, like, from my captain, he was like, oh, I don't know. Like, you know, you have a felony, it's going to be pretty hard for you to be able to be a firefighter. And it just doesn't make sense to me. I'm like, I should be able to do this. I learn how to fight wildland fires at least. Like, I at least should be a wildland firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
So as I continued to just fall in love with it, me and my co-founder, Brendan Smith, got together and he was like, look, we want to pursue it as a career when we get home. Let's figure it out. And then it's surely enough, I found out, like, you go to academy, certifications, how to apply to the Forest Service, and just like it just started happening. And then on our very first professional fire, like I saw my old crew, and when they see me in those greens, and it was like, oh my God, like you actually did it. And then for me, for them to see me, they was like, oh my God, like, this is a thing. So from 2015 to 2018, we were just helping people out. And then we made it official once I got hired with Cal Fire in 2018.
Obviously, the encounter with the people you had worked with beforehand must have been mind-blowing for you and for them. And your work trying to help them get work firefighting outside of the prison system, which is clearly hard. What are the major things that your trainees still need to work on to succeed in firefighting outside of the prison system?
So the most important thing, I think, is being able to understand that you're going to have to turn on that switch, right? It's a culture thing. You being from the urban community, it's a different way of doing things, right? Because in California, the fire service is dominated by white Caucasian males. When I talk to folks, it's like, look, you have to conform into the fire service. You have to really understand the culture, the customs and all that in order for you to fit in. That's the most critical piece. And then you also think about, folks are considered public nuisance when they go in prison. We want to change that view for people to look at them as a public servant. So you have to, like, a mindset of, you're a hero. You're not a villain anymore. You're not the black sheep of your family. You're not a menace to society. You're actually a Biden citizen that is worthy of this opportunity and understand mental stability, right? And like, you have to have your emotions in check. You are a public figure. So it's a really 180 turn. And when you think about the most beloved occupations in the United States of America, firefighters on the top of the list, right? So they got to conform their mind into believing that they are a good person and they can change their ways and move forward from whatever the past that they had. So that's one of the elements. And then dealing with the things that they have dealt with, mental health, right? All those different things play a big part in them being successful when they come home. And that's what we do at FFRP, providing those different wraparound services.
Yeah. With that said, your company's, what, 10 years old? I think you said you founded it in 2015.
Hey, so unofficially 2015.
Officially 2018.
Yeah.
No, it's in Northern California, Southern California. How do you think the organization has grown and changed in that, I'll just say, the seven-year period?
So let me be real. Climate change is beating us up.
Yes.
Wildfires is on a rampage.
Yep.
And there's a massive personnel shortage in emergency services dating back to the 1940s when the fire camp started, right? So when you evaluate all that, you got to really look at, like, how can you turn over and get people into these careers? And like, so we give them the basic 4 weeks of training that they need in order for them to get an entry-level position. With the Forest Service, Cal Fire, or even other private contract crews and stuff.
Okay.
And then the latter half is more based on field mitigation work and all the wraparound services piece. And then having an alumni network to help continue the mentorship, because that's a key piece too.
That's a very key
piece. People don't really realize. And now that I have over 300 people got jobs in the fire service since our existence, we have a lot of people that's around that could be able to help cultivate in relationships and understand how it feels, right? To be in that space so we can have trainer, like mentor to mentor folks, right? To get them going. And it's amazing. So we can be able to have more capacity, because that's where a lot of my funders, a lot of folks ask me around the country now, like, how can we scale this thing? So I'm in a process of building up an apprenticeship program. We do a lot of field mitigation work throughout Northern California, Southern California. I want to start with a 20-person crew down south and 20-person crew up north. And that'll be a more leadership training that I can be able to provide for folks. So then once they finish their apprenticeship, they have more certifications, more abilities to go to Cal Fire, the Forest Service, and be more of a candidate in any space, whether it's forestry or even fire. Wow. So I'm trying to be innovative, be creative in long term as far as providing more opportunities for folks.
That's impressive. The last question I guess I'll ask you is, of all this stuff, what has made you the most proud?
It's funny that you say that. I just got a text from one of my graduates for cohort 3. And he's like, Chief, I just finally bought my house.
Wow.
In Riverside County. He's a firefighter out with Cal Fire. And he showed me a video of his house and his 5-bedroom, 4-bath. With his kids saying, Daddy, you know, I got a new room. And his wife was like, yeah, this is my new closet. And like, just seeing the, like, changing a life piece. Because, you know, we saved the state money. You know, it costs about $132,000 $860 to house one person in California prison for 1 year.
Yep.
And to see this individual going from prison to have purpose, that's what makes me most proud of seeing the transformation. Wow. My mission is simple. Every formerly incarcerated person shouldn't be defined for their worst mistake they ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And they are worthy of dignity, hope, and a real shot at a better life.
Amen to that. If you are interested in finding out more about Royal Ramey and the Forest and Fire Recruitment Program, go to the interweb. You can watch the TED Talk. Rather amazing individual. Royal Ramey, thank you for joining State of the Bay. Really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Nah, thank you for having me, and I'm excited to come back anytime. Just let me know.
Oh, we'll bring you back.
All right, we'll do it.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of our conversation. Tune in next Monday at 6 for more live and local conversations about Bay Area life, culture, and politics. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit us at State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us anytime at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Heather Hughes. The last segment was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator.